welcome to the Aussie Pastor Live, right here on Faith FM.
G'day, my name is Lloyd Grolleman and I'm the Aussie Pastor coming to you live today from Western Australia. I want to welcome Hunty and Robbie to this very special broadcast.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
How are you guys going?
It's good to be here. Oh, it is hot today.
It is. What are we doing here?
We're at this convention of mass proportions in the West.
It's a camp.
It's a camp meeting, a bit like they used to have in the old days. They used to call them Sawdust Trail camp meetings, where they'd set up tents, all the believers come in, there's singing, there's Bible study, there's prayer, there's preaching. It's an amazing time, actually, and I think in this state, Western Australia, happens once a year. And there was, yesterday someone said, 6,000 plus people on the ground.
That's amazing. I mean, look, the thing is, this is a massive state, and everyone from over the whole state's coming here to Perth to convene for this event. So it's an ecstatic atmosphere.
And we're running live.
This is live.
And so there's a fair bit of noise outside. What's going on outside, Hunter?
So, yes, if you can hear the noise outside, they've actually got a market food court running next to us.
It's a wonder you're not out there then, mate.
Mate, it smells so good, doesn't it? How good does it smell?
Actually, Hunty's not doing too well today. He's got the dreaded Lurgin, so we've got him. I've got him.
I've put you down fair. Look at that.
Yeah, I'm
down. Oh, thanks. I'm going to get it down here.
That's right.
Robbie's bulletproof, so don't
worry. I'm upwind to Hunty today, which is a good thing, but we hope you get better, mate.
Thanks, mate.
Why are we here, Robbie? What are we doing?
Well, you were going to be here as a speaker. I'm here as a workshop speaker as well. And I think you had the crazy idea of let's do Faith FM Live from Western Australia.
It's not the first time we've done Faith FM Live from a camp meeting.
No, it's not the first time. It's the first time Western Australia, though. We've never done a live program from Western Australia.
No, that's right. And in fact, is this the first live program ever from Western Australia?
We did one in May last year.
So we're not breaking history.
Well, there's the biggest audience, put it that way. No, we open up the studio in Mamarapa. It's an Indigenous Christian training college here in Eastern Perth. And we put a studio in there in May last year, and we did one of our first episodes live from there.
So you're not doing live radio from Mamarapa now?
No, not currently. There is a plan to do it like ongoing.
Is there radio programs coming out of Mamarapa?
Yeah, there's a program called Australian Stories, and it's Indigenous people sharing their faith story of how they found Jesus and how they become followers of Jesus. They're fascinating stories. So if you've missed them, you can get them on the Faith FM app or website. Look for Australian Stories.
Mamarapa is an Indigenous Bible college,
is it? So they take two types of students. They take students wanting to study ministry and then community, like public health programs to better the health in Indigenous environments.
We have a couple of Aboriginal Indigenous schools in Western Australia. I think there's another one called Karalundi.
Yes.
Which is way out west somewhere.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone who works at Karalundi this morning, and it sounded like a great adventure out there.
The distances here are crazy. I'm from Queensland, and we got some big distances over there. But when they talk over here, like, oh, where are you from? Oh, like 17 hours away. I'm like, oh, man.
I'm from Sydney, and I met a guy today who said he came further than I did.
Really?
And he's from WA.
That's not possible.
Right up the top north, it is.
More than 4,000 Ks.
Apparently. Apparently you go around the coast all the way down.
If you follow the coast, maybe.
Yeah. So there you go.
Okay.
On my iPhone, because I got this tracking feature with my family, so I can see my wife's phone and stuff. She's back in Queensland, obviously. And it tells me right now, as the crow flies, my wife is some 3,066 kilometres away.
I drove over here, and I drove 3,000, I think it's about 3,990 Ks or something from Sydney to here.
Yeah.
And I came straight. I didn't go around the bend or anything. On the way home, I'll do more Ks. The reason I drove over here is because on the way back, I don't know whether Hunty's going to come with me or not. He was going to.
The plan is to, yes.
But he's sick, so he might be flying home. But the idea is on the way back, we're going to do some programs for...
For the Aussie Pastor program.
Yeah, that's right.
This is for video footage too,
video,
right?
Stuff, yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Now, we're in the middle of a series.
A masterclass series.
I keep forgetting masterclass. I'm not used to being involved in anything that's called masterclass, unless it's a masterclass on misbehaviour. But so it's a masterclass on what?
We're looking at Book of Revelation. You know, you've talked to elements of it, of Revelation, while you've been here at the camp, and so have I. And so we thought, let's sit down and just... There's no notes here. There's no prep. We just sit down and have a conversation on probably the three most pinnacle chapters in the book. It's not the start, it's not the end, it's sort of the centre of the story, which captures really the origin and its conclusion in just three short chapters.
Now, before we go to a song,
yes,
and Hunty's going to give us a phone number.
I will.
I wonder if just very briefly you can encapsulate where we went on Saturday, Sabbath, with Revelation chapter 12.
So chapter 12 is sort of the centre of the book Revelation, and it introduces the three main players in the cosmic, what we call cosmic conflict. Introduces
in the real Star Wars.
The real Star Wars, yeah.
It truly is.
We talked about the Star Wars the other day, didn't we?
Yeah, this is genuinely bona fide the real Star Wars. In fact, you were telling us George Lucas got some elements from this story for his story.
Yes, I've seen George Lucas do a documentary from the 1970s on the great hit of Star Wars as it was. And he shared that he had read from Revelation 12, got some inspiration from the overarching story. He also looked at other like the samurais and things like that as well. It wasn't just the Bible, but the Bible.
Well, there's an argument that a lot of them got elements of their story from the Bible too, the Bible being the original story. Okay, just briefly, you've got three major players.
We've got the family of God in the symbol of the woman. It has different stages and phases, but ultimately it's the family of God.
Star Wars saga, we would say this is...
be the good guys.
The light.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
The force, the good side, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Then the other character is the opposite of that, which is called the dragon, the symbol of the dragon. And the dragon is... it's spelt out in the text that that's the devil and Satan, same person. And then in the middle of this sort of introduction of these two characters, a third character is introduced, and that is this... it's sort of like this. It's called a male child. In the context, we talk about
he's
it the
hero
other day.
Of the story. This
he's the hero,
character.
And
he comes to. Actually, I was thinking about it. He comes to save the woman.
Absolutely,
that's what it's about.
Absolutely,
this is actually a little bit like the king or the prince coming to save the princess from the dragon.
Every one of the fairy tales and stories we have in human history has some anchor back to this.
It does. It's amazing, isn't it, when you really think about it?
You know, it's the ultimate story of truth versus evil and light versus darkness and right and wrong and all of that.
I often thought of writing a book about these three chapters because I actually really like them.
Yeah.
And I think I'd call it The Prince, The Princess and The Dragon. Is that a cool...
I'm looking forward to seeing... Hey, you can use AI to write it now. You can get it done.
I hear some people are using AI to get through university.
Yeah.
That's another...
You might get through, but you're not going to last long outside, I guess.
No, you wouldn't, would you?
You won't have the skills to think and reason. Anyway, we're getting off track here.
So basically, it's set up where we're going today.
Exactly. So I guess the takeaway, the transition from, if you missed on, I think it was Friday or Saturday, whatever day we did it, the transition from that program to this program is Revelation 12 verse 17 ends with the idea that now all the players are here. It starts off in heaven, but it all ends here on earth. And it ends with a scene that there is going to be war waged against the woman, the church, God's people. And it's going to be waged in a way that seems like in the last verse, it's not going to be pretty. But we're not told how or where.
What about the last verse of Revelation 12?
Yes, Revelation 12, 17.
Where it says
the dragon,
Satan was enraged with the woman, God's people, and went off to make war with her.
Exactly.
And that's where we're going now.
So today's class, if you want to call it that, is chapter 13. And this is going to look at how Satan is going to wage that war. But then the good news is chapter 14 is how God's going to come back.
So in a sense, we go for a little walk into the darkness today.
Yeah, you could. You could definitely say that. And so it's important to keep that perspective in mind, because there's going to be some things that are going to be probably a little bit like, oh boy, that's not super inspiring. Mm-hmm. But hold on to your horses, because it turns out pretty well.
Actually, believe it or not, I love this chapter.
Me too.
Revelation 13. There is darkness in it, but it's not all darkness. You kind of get glimpses all the way through it that God's people are standing up. There's victories going on.
Yeah.
Well, look, without further ado, I think we'll get Hunty to give a call out about if you've got some questions, and perhaps open with a prayer.
Okay, so this topic is very deep, it's very complex, but it's very, very interesting. So if either Pastor Lloyd or Pastor Robbie spark questions in your mind, we want you to send them to us.
Would we answer them today?
If you get them to us early enough, perhaps. Because the open line is open.
I think you'd have a go today.
We would have a go, yeah. So feel free to text us. The text number is 0488880851, or you can email us. The email address is theaussiepastor@gmail.com. That text number again, 0488880851. Now, listeners, we are so blessed and grateful to have you with us this afternoon. And right now, I'd like to pray for you before we start. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for all these beautiful people who've tuned in to listen to your holy scriptures, Lord. Thank you so much for them, Lord. I pray you'll bless them all today. Wrap your loving arms around them with peace and comfort. And Lord, slowly bring them closer to you, I ask in your precious name, Jesus. Amen.
You're listening to the Aussie Pastor here on Faith FM.
Release. I can sing. I am free and not.
That's not yet I, but through Christ in me from City of Light. And I did that all from memory. So my brain's not gone too badly today, Hunty.
Correct.
I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again.
Yeah.
But that song is written by my youngest son's high school teacher.
Correct.
And if she's listening, I've been trying to get you to come to New Hope for some time with your group and sing that. We love City of Light, don't we, Hunty?
We sure do.
Revelation chapter 13, I would call this chapter the Day of the Dragon. But as I said before, there's a lot of positive stuff in this. I'm going to just start by reading verse 1 to 3, and I'm going to open it up to you, mate.
Let's do it.
I'm reading from the NLT. I think you're in the NKJV. You made the comment yesterday that it's not a bad thing to come at prophetic Bible study and deep Bible study from a number of different translations.
100%. Because you got to remember that, again, this is not, this was written in another language.
Yeah.
So anything we're reading that's not Greek is a translation of it. And no translation is exactly what the original author had. So the more you can compare, the better picture you get.
So when you're studying Bible prophecy, and I know you love Bible prophecy.
Yes.
How many translations would you use generally if you're doing an in-depth study of a prophecy in the Bible?
So I've got software that allows me, so in the old days, like you know, 20 years ago, I had a Bible that had was parallel, parallel Bible. Four translations in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd have the interlinear with the Greek or the Hebrew. So that's what I'd use. Now you've got all these tools at our hands. It's so much simpler. So I've got software that lets me have, like, I think it's 32 translations.
Yeah.
All down the page. So when you're looking at one text, you get that same text all the way down the page in every possible English translation.
And you do get a deeper insight when you're doing that.
Hey,
just for our listeners, what is an interlinear?
So interlinear is, imagine taking the original Greek writing, like, so imagine a Greek sentence.
Yep.
You have that on the page, and then right below it, for each of those Greek words in the sequence that the Greek is written, it'll put the English, best English equivalent. So like a dictionary lookup
sort
of thing.
Is it helpful?
It's helpful, yes, but it's very hard to just read the English, because when you read an English translation, they've taken the structure out of the Greek and made it work for English.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, I'll give you, it might say, the text might say, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. It might say, beginning created God, heaven, earth, sort of thing. Like, it won't be like flowing.
So there's really no such thing as a literal English translation, because you do have to put the words in order so they make sense in the English.
That's why they're all called translations. It's a translation from one thought to the other thought. And, you know, there's a spectrum of translation. There's more like the thought for thought.
Yep.
So they read the thought in Greek and or Hebrew, and then they make the equivalent thought in English, which is more your paraphrases, like the message and those sorts of translations. Yep. And then you go all the way down the other end of the spectrum, which is literal word for word, which is your interlinears.
Like the Revised Standard Version and some of that.
Yeah, like the Old King James, Revised English Standard.
Which one would you rather use? Do you rather use the more literal, or would you rather... Which way?
So when I first started as a Christian, I just gravitated to wanting to be closest to the word-for-word translations, which makes it harder in English, but you're more confident that you're closer to the original intent of the text.
Yeah.
So when I study Scripture, if it's sort of like I'm trying to understand doctrine and things, which is what I'm going to base my belief system on, I want to be closer to the word-for-word. But like in devotional reading and just trying to spend time with the story and the word, the easier reads are much more meaningful. So you kind of go... Not necessarily. I try to stick in the middle of the road.
Translations are pretty safe for us to read.
Look, this is one thing that gripes me. There's all these camps that say it's only this translation and everything else is evil and it's the devil's tool. That's so blasphemous.
Yeah, it is.
We're talking about God's word taken from
it's an attack on his word.
Well, we're saying God's spoken in this language, in this culture, and it's being translated into our language and our culture. And not every... Like, I'm sure you've preached with translators before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not every translator is amazing.
No.
Some of them are actually pretty difficult to work with. Others are fantastic. They can almost preempt what you want to say in English.
I preached a sermon once, won't say where it was, in a country, and someone came up to me and said that the translator preached a completely different sermon.
I've had that too.
I've had that too. Yeah,
It wasn't even the same topic.
So I guess what I'm saying is you can rely on the Bible. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I guess what I was trying to... if you go to a hardware store and want to buy a hammer... there's a whole range of hammers you can buy. You can buy a $2 hammer all the way to a $52 hammer. Obviously, the $52 hammer is better quality versus the $2 hammer, but they're all going to get the job done. and I look at English translations like that. There's the $2 hammer and there's the $52 hammer and there's everything in between. They'll all get the job done, which is they'll all lead you to Jesus.
Do you think that God's protected the Bible and the translations in a special way?
The Bible tells us that. The book of Psalms says that God's word is protected. And the great thing is, like, the discoveries in archaeology, which is something I'm very passionate about, because archaeology validates whether what we're studying here is, in fact, what they were studying back then or what was written. Yeah. And from every archaeological discovery that's been found to date, not one discovery has proven a contradiction of the Bible. In fact, it's done the opposite.
Yeah.
So I'm 100% confident that when you pick up, like, the Hebrew text, it's exactly what Jesus was using in his day, and even 600 years before his day, it's the same
text. What's been amazing, and I know we'll get onto the Bible study in a minute, but what has been amazing is the way when they find things like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
And the accuracy of the Dead Sea Scrolls to the modern translations, you just got to go, wow.
The only variation is spelling.
Yeah.
And there's some grammar differences. Not that there's not much grammar in Hebrew, but there's a couple of grammar things, and most of it's the spelling of nouns.
Yeah.
So names of places and things change different spellings.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, for those who don't know, were fragments of the Bible found in a cave way down on the Dead Sea. We've seen that cave, Hunter, you and me. You have or you haven't?
I'm going there in February.
It's fantastic.
If the war ends.
It's quite awe-inspiring, actually. To go
to the museum.
And with those fragments of which had been hidden in those caves for more than 2,000 years.
Yeah, the oldest one's 2,200.
And they pull them out, and the manuscripts in those caves were very similar to what the manuscripts were used to translate the Bible. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm so confident that God... It's almost like God says about the Bible to Satan, no, don't touch. That's one thing you're not going to mess around
with.
And that gives me confidence. Okay, let's get into this Bible study, mate. The day of the dragon, darkness descends on the earth. Revelation 13, verse 1. Then I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. It had 7 heads and 10 horns, with 10 crowns on its horns, and written on each head were names that blaspheme God. The beast looked like a leopard, but it had the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave the beast his own power and throne and great authority. Who is this beast? Or unpack for us this beast that rises up out of the sea with the symbols that are here.
That's the key. The key is the symbols. Mm. Like we said on our first class, that in verse 1, Revelation says that Jesus, when he gives this revelation to John, it goes through an angel, and through that process, it's signified or encoded. And so symbols is the key. It's not about looking at what CNN or Fox News or whatever your news sources are, how to interpret it. Mm. You know, I know some people will go, oh, look, it's talking about bears here. Well, that must be Russia. Mm. Or lions. That must be either England or China. Mm. You know, or dragons are definitely Chinese, whatever, right? But we're going to do it based on what the Bible
says. In other words, you're going to use the biblical keys to unlock this biblical prophecy.
There's only one way to do it, and that's exactly it.
Get the keys out and show us, mate.
So if we look at the first symbol we get there, it says, I stood on the sand of the sea. So we've already got a bit of a hint to this, because in our last class in chapter 12, we saw that the earth was going to help the woman, the church,
that was amazing,
from the flood of the waters.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty much along those lines. If we go to Revelation 17...
15.
Verse 15, exactly. It tells us there that the water represents peoples, multitudes,
so there's a key,
nations and tongues. That's a
so
key.
So does that mean when I'm doing Bible prophecy and I see that water come up in this sort of context, I can confidently say it probably, and I'm saying probably, means lots and lots and lots of people.
You got it exactly right when you said it shares the same context.
Yeah.
So if the symbol shares the same context, that's generally 100% the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're going to see the word sea and water is used a lot in Revelation, and every time it is, it's connected to a multitude of people.
So this beast is coming from a place
where populated
there's a multitude
place.
Of people.
Yeah.
Okay, go on.
Remember, on Revelation 12, we saw that the people were coming from a place of the waters to a place of the earth.
Can I remind them?
Yeah, go ahead.
They were coming from Europe.
The old world.
And they were headed to the new world.
Yes, to the Western
the
Hemisphere.
States, yeah.
So
I was thinking about that last night. Can you take that to include places like Australia, or is it specifically... So when the Bible says the people of God, the family of God in Revelation 12, were escaping from this oppressive power, the Holy Roman Empire, and they're escaping to the earth, swallowed up the persecution, so that they went to a place where there was very few people. Does it exclusively have to mean the United States, or could it mean places like Australia and New Zealand and other nations that were opening up similar time? I'm just wondering about
that. My take on it is, because in Revelation there are two words, one is world and one is earth, and they're both different words, and they're used in different ways. So when it says something like, we're going to read this in a few verses from now, it says the whole world wandered after the beast. That's different to where it says, and the earth helped the woman.
So they're different
places.
The
beast came up out of the earth in verse 11. Yeah, so they're different.
Yeah.
So I would suggest from my study that when it's using the word earth, we're talking about the new world, as in like the Western Hemisphere, as in, not that's probably even too vague. I'm specifically, in my mind, it's North America.
Good. That's what I'm trying to find out. So you've got a beast coming from a place where there's lots and lots of people. Go on, mate.
Yeah. So that means that what John's witnessing here in verse 1, because remember, chapter 13 isn't in isolation. It's off the back of chapter 12.
Yeah.
And chapter 12 has already laid us a 1260-year time period we talked about being the dark ages of
538 to 1798. Great persecution on people of God.
That's right. And we already saw how that the earth, which is North America, opened up, the pilgrims came across. So that's the backdrop for this chapter. So we're not getting this in isolation.
In some sense, this chapter's explaining what happened in that 12...
Yeah, it is.
60 years, isn't
it? Yeah, and we actually see the same time period mentioned in coming verses.
Okay.
So the first symbol we have here is the location. The sea is the location. So we know that this is old world, or a densely populated old world. The next thing that you see here is that it says it's a beast. Now, in the Bible, especially in the book of Daniel, beasts are representative of powers, as in kingdoms.
Daniel 7 says that, doesn't it?
Exactly. Daniel 7, from the whole chapter, you can read it, but verse 25, it talks about it. Verse 17 talks about it. And so what we're seeing is that this thing coming up out of this populated space is some kind of new power, some sort of new system, political entity. But in Daniel, it's always a political entity. But what we'll see here, I think, did you read verse
3? Yep.
Did you read verse 3?
So we're going to go there in a moment. We read verse 2.
Sorry, still in verse 1. See the last part of verse 1? It says, on his head was a blasphemous name. And this word blasphemy,
it basically means something that brings God's name, God's authority, God's being into terrible disrepute.
And so that puts us in a religious dimension, not a political dimension.
Yeah.
So here we have a political power coming up, or some sort of power rising out of the old world, but it's got religious domain as well as political domain.
This is actually just John the Revelator, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the voice of Jesus in his ear, building on Revelation 12.
That's exactly what's happening here.
He laid the foundation in Revelation 12, now he's building the house.
Yeah, and the reason we're building this out is to answer the question of verse 17. Yeah. How does this war happen against God's people in the last days? Yeah. How does it happen? And so he's giving us a bit of a history lesson to get us up to the present, which comes at the end of this chapter.
You've got a political religious power that's coming out of a place where there's lots of people. It blasphemes God. Tell us about verse 2.
So let's have a look in verse 2. It says, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. So if you were standing on the shore of the sea and you were looking out at the sea and you saw this animal, this beast, this power coming up out, it would look like a leopard from a distance, right? So that's the shape of it. You saw just a silhouette, it's a leopard. Now, what's the next animal description, Lloyd?
Verse 2, the beast looked like a leopard, but it had the feet of a bear.
Feet of a bear, okay, keep going.
And the mouth of a lion.
Lion, and then?
And the dragon gave the beast his own power and throne and great authority. You know, I don't know where you're going to go on this because we haven't really talked.
This is the fun of it.
But I'm seeing Daniel 2 in this.
Daniel 7.
Daniel 7.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, Daniel 2 was the beginning of Daniel 7.
Daniel 7's anchored. 7. Yeah, spot on.
Yeah.
So, I don't think we said this. We're in front of a live audience here. We've got people sitting here gawking at us while we're doing the show. So I'm going to throw out some questions. Is that all right?
Let's go.
Make it more interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So we just talked about verse 2, and it says that if you look at this beast, it looks like a leopard, right? It looks like a leopard. But then it has the feet of a bear, the mouth of a lion, and something gave its power. What was the other?
The dragon.
Okay. So here's a quick... I'm assuming you're all Bible students. Let me ask you a question. In the book of Daniel, what did the leopard represent? Because it's in Daniel 7. All these animals are in Daniel 7. Okay. Greece. So the answer was Greece. Is that correct, Lloyd?
That's right on the money. Actually, it goes right. It does go right back to Daniel 2, doesn't it?
Yeah, because Daniel 7's built on Daniel 2. Yeah,
this is Greece.
Yes.
So this, what you're saying then is that this power has elements and it has characteristics of Greece.
It has the body of Greece.
Yeah.
So okay.
Do you want to tell us what that means before you go on?
100%. So okay. So this is anchoring us back to Daniel. Yep. In Daniel, what was Greece? Well, actually, it's not in Daniel, but in terms of history, what was Greece famous for? There's a couple of characteristics, but there's one thing that Greece is absolutely famous for, even today. What do they give Western civilization? Philosophy, human reasoning and philosophy. And that's why, even today, where do people go for tertiary education? Universities. Unity in diversity is a Greek invention. It's they invented this, right? So when you look at this beast coming up out of the old world, it's based on human philosophy and
rather than divine, rather than the Bible. Yeah.
So that's the structure of the system. But then how does a beast move? It moves with its feet, right? So what's the feet? Which animal? Bear. And a bear is? Guys, I can't hear you with my headphones. It's Medo-Persia, right? What was Medo-Persia? This is in Daniel. What was Medo-Persia famous for in the book of Daniel? What was the characteristic of the empire? They're thinking.
I'm thinking too. I actually know the history fairly well. Medo-Persia.
Think of chapter 6 of Daniel. What's Medo-Persia famous for?
Force.
What kind of force? Well, okay, yes, but why?
Religion.
Yes.
Religious force.
Okay, so Daniel is in the lion's den. Why?
Because he was praying.
Why? That's true. Huh? Okay, I'm going to help you out. Here it is.
You're going to have to help us out, brother, because we're not on this railroad track.
Somebody came to the king and said, let's make a law.
That's right, very good.
That's related to worship, right? But what kind of law was it? The laws of the Medes and Persians are what kind of laws?
Irrefutable.
Irrefutable, like unchangeable. Mm. Do you know what that is called? It's an infallible law. A law that cannot be changed is a law that does not need to be changed because it's a perfect law. It's infallible.
Okay.
So here you have a beast rising up out of the old world that has the structure of human reasoning and philosophy. And when it walks, when it moves, it's moving on the basis of Medo-Persia, which is infallibility.
I want to say who this beast is because this is all lining up already.
It's lining up. It's 100%. Okay, here's the next one. What's the mouth? Lion. Lion is which kingdom in Daniel? Babylon. What is Babylon famous for in the book of Daniel? Okay, I can't hear him.
False worship.
Yes.
That's what they're saying.
But what kind of false worship? False worship, yes.
They set up an image.
It's about forced worship. You worship. Daniel chapter 2, sorry, chapter 3. The image is put up by the king.
Shadrach, Meshach,
and if you don't worship, you die, right? So it's forced worship. And then we get into this idea in chapter 13. We'll see it about another image. And if you don't worship, you die. Now, here's the other thing. When Jesus was here teaching in these 3.5 years, he said something really remarkable in Matthew chapter 12. He said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. You know what he means by that? He means that when you open your mouth, you reveal your character.
Yeah.
So this beast that's coming up, when it opens its mouth, it's got the mouth of what? Babylon. So what's coming out of its mouth?
It's important, that point, too, because the beast does look religious. It does, to many people, look good. It does look pure. It does look like it represents Jesus. So this is an important point. When it opens its mouth, so we need to listen.
It's got the heart of Babylon.
Yeah, we need to listen to what religions and what denominations and what movements say.
Yeah.
When are we going 100%. To identify who this beast is?
One more.
Okay. All right. And the dragon gave the beast.
So what gives the power to it is the dragon, right? In Daniel.
This is actually very confronting when it comes home to you.
It is.
The reason I say that is my great-grandfather was a part of this movement.
I've got friends that are a part of this movement, this system.
He came out of it, and it did cause pain because you think that you're in a movement that is bringing you closer to Christ, that is providing for you the way to salvation. But it's not.
Mm.
And it's very confronting. I think it's important as we do this that people understand as they're listening that this is about It's about powers. It's not about individual people.
There's not a single person's mentioned in this passage.
Yeah, we're not bringing
it's about a structure.
People into disrepute here.
100%.
We're just talking about great powers. Do you want to unpack any more on the dragon gave the beast its authority? Yeah, we hear you, hunty.
Are you trying to give us a song?
Yeah,
but trying to
let's see if we can get
Let
through
this. Let me just
this
do this and you do
yeah,
this song. Okay.
Yeah.
In the book of Daniel, take your minds back, chapter 7, what's the sequence of the animals? He says there'll be there's four animals. What's the first one we see in Daniel chapter 7?
Lion.
We see the lion come up out of the sea, which is Babylon. And then we see the bear, Medo-Persia. Then we see the leopard.
With the four wings.
Which is the four wings, which is Greece. And then we see the dragon-looking thing, right, with the horns. That's Rome. So when Daniel is back from your side here, back in time, he describes it as lion, leopard, bear, leopard, dragon, right? When John's looking at it and writing, guess what he writes?
Leopard.
Leopard, bear,
lion.
It's the reverse. Mm. And so he doesn't talk about the dragon because he's actually living under the power of Rome. He's in that time period. So what we're seeing is
he's looking back.
John's looking back and Daniel's looking forward, which gives us the perfect key to lock these two prophecies together.
Fantastic.
So we know for sure that we are talking about the power that receives all of this from the Imperial Roman Empire at some point. So I don't know if we're going to go to
the song. Fantastic. Let's have a song, hunty.
You're listening to the Aussie Pastor here on Faith FM.
that's Crown Him with Many Crowns. And one day, Hunty, our producer-director, will tell us who that was, mate.
I might.
Yeah, but yes. We don't know right now.
No, we don't.
Hey, do you want to just give a quick shout-out if you want to get
if
a question
to us?
Questions,
we'd like to hear them. 0488 880 851. Or you can email them to us, and the email address is theaussiepastor@gmail.com.
Now, Robbie, I want to go back to verse 2. And the dragon gave the beast his own power, a throne and great authority. You want to unpack that just a little more?
Well, if we go back to Daniel 7, like we were talking before the break, we've got this picture of Babylon, followed by Medo-Persia, then by Greece, and then by what we call pagan Rome or imperial Rome.
This actually all came out of a vision that God gave Nebuchadnezzar, a pagan king.
Pretty
and
amazing.
It's really much built on that vision. And that's in Daniel 2. And Daniel 7 actually builds on what we know in Daniel 2.
Yes.
And it's in Daniel 2 that we get Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece and Rome.
Yes.
So in Daniel 7, it unpacks it more. Would it be fair to say Revelation 13 now is using that?
It's
applying it?
Yes. There's a principle of repeating and enlarging with Bible prophecy. So something like when Daniel was given around 600 BC,
Here
we've got Revelation around 100 AD, I mean 97, 96. So it's about a 700-year period between Daniel and Revelation, and we're getting something that's repeating but then enlarging.
So
when we look at Daniel 7, we know the dragon is representative of pagan Rome.
Yep.
So now we're looking for a power that's coming up in the old world. It has the characteristics of human philosophy and reasoning. It walks on infallible law.
So the dragon's not just Satan. It also symbolizes pagan Rome.
So remember our last class, we said that in Revelation 12...
The serpent.
At the highest level of the symbol, at global, universal level, the dragon is Satan.
That's right.
But then when we come down, there's a national level. It was Rome. And an individual that tried to kill baby Jesus was Herod.
Yep.
So you have these layers of the symbol. But behind it all is Satan working through it.
So the dragon here is representative as pagan Rome.
It'll be pagan Rome.
So this power has to get its authority from pagan Rome.
Its authority. It's two things. It says specifically. It says the authority, and I believe it says seat. I've just got my glasses on here. So it says, or throne, in some translations it's seat.
Yeah.
So it says it gave him his power, that's number one, his throne and authority, great authorities.
So bring this down to reality now. What power are we talking about and what happened?
So what we find is that in 538, we have a new entity, a new system of power, of operational power in Europe, become a legal identity. And I'll just read a quote here I've got on my screen. This comes from a book called The History of the Christian Church, Volume 3, page 327. It says, the legally recognized supremacy of the Roman papacy became effective in 538 AD when there went into effect a decree of Emperor Justinian.
This who, by the way, was in Byzantine.
Which is a Roman. Roman emperor.
The Roman emperor Justinian, just so you get the historical context, had moved the seat of political power from Rome to Byzantine. He actually had a general, I'm not going to go into this too much because I don't want to usurp what you're doing, called Belisarius. And there was actually a change of bishops here. Did you know about that story?
Tell me more.
Go on and then I'll tell it because I want them to hear what you're saying first. It's more important.
No.
Basically, Belisarius, Rome was under attack by the Goths and there was a godly bishop in Rome at the time and the Belisarius and the Roman troops had been backed up to the walls of Rome. You know who I get this story from? And then I went and checked it out. Kenneth Cox.
Oh, okay.
He's a great evangelist. Passed on.
Yes.
But he used to tell this story. And they'd backed up, the Goths had been, they had backed the Roman army. Look, when I was coming across the desert, I'm listening to the history behind Belisarius and it's all there.
Oh, right.
So the Goths had backed the Roman, and they couldn't get in the walls because the bishop of Rome was a godly man and said, we don't want this fighting in the city. Anyway, Belisarius' wife, who was a Christian, came to the bishop and said, look, would you be prepared to let the Roman army in? Or there's going to be a massacre. So, Christian heart opens up the gates and in comes the army. They then shut the gates. Belisarius then, at the command of Justinian and others, removes the bishop of Rome and replaces him with a man called Sylvester. You can see it in history.
Yeah.
It's all there, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And Sylvester was the first bishop of Rome to hold not just secular, not just religious authority, but Justinian and Belisarius invested in him
political
authority. Yeah. So for the first time in the history of the church, you've got a Bishop Silvestus, who I think really is the first pope.
Yes.
If you really want to look at the history and look at it properly, you've got a bishop who's got now invested in him from Justinian, and Belisarius the general was enforcing it, both religious and political power. It's an amazing story. When I first heard it from Kenneth Cox, blew me away. And being a bit of a history buff, I then had to go and check it out.
Check it out for yourself.
Not that I didn't believe Kenneth Cox.
Oh, it's always good to check the sources.
And the story's true and the story's real, and it is amazing. Just behind the scenes, it's amazing how it happened. Sorry, mate.
No,
don't want to hijack this.
Exactly the same story you're talking about. It's great to have a bit of more context to it. So it says that basically the position of the papacy began in 538 AD. So this goes against some of sort of these stories we get told that Peter was the first pope and all sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, completely.
Because it's 538 and it says...
By the way, that's why we've got the beginning of this prophecy.
That's how we know.
This is it.
That's it.
And then we add the Church of Rome getting political and religious power. This is huge. I don't think we realise how earth-shattering this is.
It's fundamentally earth-shattering. It changed my worldview for sure.
Yeah.
So it says, it went into effect a decree by Emperor Justinian making the Bishop of Rome, which is what you just said, the head over all the churches, the definer of doctrine, and the corrector of heretics, and he ascended to the papal chair under military protection. So,
it's Belisarius.
So I want you to notice this. He's received authority, he's received power, and he's received a seat. The seat being what we call today the Vatican, or was Rome in those days, but Vatican today. So what we're looking at here is that Rome, the dragon here, he does exactly that. Imperial Rome, or pagan Rome, gives exactly those three things across to this new power that's emerging, but now it's got the shape of a political system based on human reasoning. It's walking in this idea of infallibility, but when it opens its mouth, it forces people to worship the way it tells you to, and it does it all with the power of the old empire of Rome. Mm. So what we're looking at is none other than what we'd call today the Holy Roman Empire of the past. Mm. And that existed for the 1260 years we talked about on our first class until Napoleon had enough of it and marched over there with Berthier and took him off the throne, and he divorced the church from the state. The church still remained, but the state went to a republic.
I find it really interesting that it was a general, Belisarius, under Justinian,
that put him in.
The Pope first in place, and then it was a general, Berthier, who took him off his throne.
That's exactly right.
I just found that very interesting when I was looking at this.
Now watch this. This blew my mind when I saw this. This power, John says, it rises up out of the water, right? Mm. Out of the sea. If you jump down just for a second to verse 5, notice how long this power is going to do its thing for.
The beast was allowed to speak great blasphemies. This is Rome.
Yes.
This is religious Rome.
Yes.
The beast was religious and political Rome. The beast was allowed to speak great blasphemies against God and was given authority to do whatever he wanted for 42 months, which is 1260 days.
Okay, exactly right. So we know it's the same time period of chapter 12, but watch this. 42 months is how many years?
Three and a half. Yeah.
Okay, so watch this. When he comes up out of the water, he begins a ministry for 3.5 years.
I know where you're going.
What happens at the end of these 3.5 years, verse 3?
Verse 3 here?
Yeah.
I saw that one of the heads of the beast, love this too, seemed wounded. I'm seeing Berthier here, beyond recovery.
Yes.
But the fatal wound was healed. Then the whole world marveled at this miracle and gave allegiance to the beast.
So we have a picture here that this power is going to come up. It's symbolic, right? But this power is coming up out of the water.
Yeah.
Sounds like Jesus coming up out of the water.
Yeah.
Then this
even
power,
the 3.5 years.
This power is going to go for 3.5, what we call prophetic years. Yeah. So it's a symbol of 1260 years, but 3.5 years, which is a parallel to Jesus having a ministry for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
At the end of the 3.5 years, Jesus has a mortal wound, means he dies. Yeah. This power gets a deadly wound, which means you die. Yeah. But Jesus resurrected. This power, its wound is healed.
Resurrected almost.
What we're looking at is a complete copycat of Jesus Christ.
Mm.
The ministry of Jesus Christ is being cloned or misrepresented or counterfeited, however you want to put it, with this power. And so that's why in the other writings of John, because John wrote Revelation, he refers to this spirit and this power as the spirit of Antichrist, because it's in the place of Christ. Antichrist doesn't mean opposing and against. It means taking the place and being in the place of Christ. So all of these things point to the fact that we are looking at this first beast of Revelation chapter 13 as the rise of what we would call the Holy Roman Empire, and what Martin Luther and many of the reformers referred to as the Antichrist itself.
Rome.
That's, yeah, Rome. That was Martin Luther. That was all the reformers. I just happen to agree with them.
All the reformers to a T, the entire Protestant Reformation, bar none, is built on, partly built on this belief, this understanding of prophetic scripture.
And the key here, though, and even Martin Luther and the reformers in those days said this, this is not describing the individual. This is describing the system.
Of course.
Because no one individual can live as long as 1,260 years. Not even one pope can live that long. So even the reformers were talking about this is the system.
Yeah.
There's still salvation for the individual.
Yeah.
And we see that in Revelation 18. At another time we look at that.
So the head of the beast was wounded, but there seems to be some sort of healing or a resurrection.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So what's interesting, if in fact this is accurate, and I believe 100% this is accurate, the characteristics that we see, in fact, there's a number of characteristics. So I've got 12 characteristics here of this power being described as the sea beast.
Yep.
Every one of those fits to a T to no other system on earth
than the Holy Roman Empire. Do you know that 35 years of ministry, and I've done countless Bible studies on this with people, I've never once... I have on other Bible studies. This is the truth. I've never once, when I've sat down and unpacked it in an intimate way with people, I've never once had someone say, I can't see that. That couldn't be.
Yeah.
You know what? Not once.
You've got 12 points on your lock for this symbol. There's 12 characteristics.
That's right. You go around them and it's just irrefutable.
Yeah. There's no other power on earth that fits the system. So if that's true, which I believe it is, that means we should expect a time that the Holy Roman Empire would receive a fatal wound, which we see with Napoleon in 1798. But, so just again, to clarify, that deadly wound is the separation of the political power
from
and
the
religious power.
And so from 1798 onwards,
it's separate.
It again became a religious power only.
That's what the prophet, yes, that's right. It's religious only from that point
but
on.
But it said the wound would be healed.
So we're expecting, according to the prophecy, at some point in past 1798, those two things, the political and religious power, would have once again be united.
So the wound to be healed. Look, I've had a knee surgery just recently.
Yes.
You look at me and you'd say, the wound is healed. But the wound is not healed until I have the abilities I had before the surgery. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure.
So the wound to be healed, Rome has to have the same power, both religious and political, that she had before the wound.
Correct.
So is the wound healed?
So I'm going to say the wound is healing.
I think that's a good way to say it. Because in 1929... What happened then?
So 1929...
Lateran... You go, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, you do.
You love the history, you share it. So 1929, what happened, Lloyd?
Mussolini.
Yes.
Look, I'll put it as simply as I can. Mussolini, through a treaty, gave Rome back her both political and religious power. And that's why today, most countries on the planet, including Australia and the United States and Britain and New Zealand, the entire Western world and most of the rest of the world have share ambassadors
yes.
with the Holy Roman See.
176 ambassadors the Vatican has with other countries.
Wow. And yet there's not one other religion on the planet that shares that sort of authority, which is political.
Correct.
Every other religion is basically... Now, that's not that other religions don't take political power. I think Islam and some others most definitely do. But what you've got here is a recognition by the world of both a political and a religious power. I never forget the funeral of Pope John Paul.
Yeah. In front of when he's on the casket.
Condoleezza Rice,
yeah,
Bush,
Clinton.
Clinton, some of the most powerful people in the world standing.
So Jimmy Carter as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, standing by his casket. It was the powerful of the
kneeling,
world.
Kneeling by his casket.
They were.
Yeah.
And it was the powerful of the world acknowledging this beast,
yeah,
this power, as both political and religious. And any major political power on the planet would be crazy not to acknowledge the power of this beast because it is so powerful.
So you asked the question for what how would I word this? I would say this. In 1929, when exactly that event took place, the political part or status was given back to the church. And as you said correctly, there is no other religious institution on earth in Christianity that has political power. None. Not one. So this is it. Since that time, the political influence has been growing exponentially.
It's been healing.
In fact, I want to quote from a book. This book's profound. It's called Keys of this Blood by a former Jesuit.
That's an amazing book.
It's an amazing book.
And this guy is, for want of a better word, he's a Roman Catholic.
Yeah, he's a Jesuit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
former Jesuit, I think, now, but at the time he wrote it. He said this, in secular eyes, the Roman Church stands alone. So this is a Jesuit writing about the church. He says the Pope is, by definition, the world's first... He's talking about John Paul II. The first fully-fledged geopolitical leader. Yeah. So even themselves... And by the way, one of the newspaper articles I've got is from the San Francisco Chronicles from 1929, and it says, the wound is healed. In the day, they saw it as a revelation fulfillment.
Well, back then, America was Protestant.
It was very Protestant, yeah.
In fact, I can't remember. It took America, was it, until the 70s or something, the 80s, under Reagan, I think it was.
Yeah, to have ambassadors.
They were able to send an ambassador there because Protestant America resisted fiercely.
Yeah.
But even they...
Well, again, remember, this goes back to the prophecy. Mm. How did America start? Mm. They started with pilgrims... fleeing
escaping this power.
The power of the old world, which is the papacy. And so it makes good sense that they had this history for so long that they were opposed to
it. It was amazing, though, even back then to see Reagan reaching his hand across the Gulf to the Vatican, Protestant America grasping again the hand of the Vatican, and a healing of two great movements that had really gone head-to-head for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
To the point that in the United States, and I don't say this is right either, but no Roman Catholic could get any position, judge, governor, president. And I think it was a bit of a scandal when JFK, a serving Roman Catholic, first became the president. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong either, by the way, mate. I'm just talking about the actual reality where America was together with Rome and how now they walk hand in hand, lock, stock, together.
And it all what you're saying and looking at the history underpins the accuracy of these prophecies. Mm. These prophecies predicted that this group of people would come across and start a whole new way of doing things. And we'll touch on that in the next section, Revelation 13. And that separation was there for a very good reason. I mean, it was because of persecution from the Pope and from the Pope religiously and politically.
50+ million people martyred.
That's right. So they come over.
You go through Europe, there's blood everywhere.
They come over to this new world looking for hope and looking for direction. And they have a long memory of their past. And it's only, in, relatively speaking, it's recent history that memory is faded and fading. And we'll touch on that when we get into the second beast.
It's definitely fading. Let's have another song, Hunty, and then we'll get back into it.
You're listening to the Aussie Pastor here on Faith FM.
fabulous song written by a great Australian, Jeff Bullock. Okay, so we're back. It's part three of the Revelation Masterclass. Let me give
part
you
two.
Part two. It's actually segment three of part two.
Oh, let's confuse everyone.
Let's confuse everybody, yes.
You're at the right place at the right time.
You are. This is the Revelation Masterclass. And if you want to ask a question to either Lloyd or Robbie, 0488 880 851, or you can email us, theaussiepastor@gmail.com.
Okay, Robbie.
Here I am.
Here we go, mate. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast. Ooh. Come up out of the earth. Man. He had two horns like those of a lamb, but he spoke with the voice of a dragon.
So there's some similar symbols already that we've already sort of touched on.
This is getting easier, by the way, Robbie.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, because we're getting used to the symbols.
Yeah, that's exactly. This is what I love about Revelation, or all prophecy in general. Yeah. But people, you know, as we said in the first class, people get hung up on, oh, it's too hard to seal a book. No, no, if you just sit down and start going through it, the promise is, blessed are those that hear it, that read it, and keep it.
Can I have a go at unpacking
this? Let's do it.
Just with the keys that you've given us.
Let's do it.
Is this right? Then I saw another beast coming up out of North America.
Yep.
He had two horns like a lamb, so he had attributes of Jesus. I'm just saying that because the lamb is Jesus.
How do we know that?
Well, the Bible symbolically uses Jesus as a lamb. Go back to the Old Testament, the book of Exodus. Jesus is signified, symbolized as a Passover lamb, the sacrificial lamb.
So we have John the Baptist saying, behold, the Lamb of God.
That takes away the sins of the world.
John chapter 1, yep. So 100%.
That's kind of where I'm going from. 100%,
yep.
And
interestingly, 25 times this word lamb is used in Revelation. Every single time it refers to Jesus, except here. Well, I mean, it refers to Jesus, but it's not specifically Jesus here. But yeah.
Well, it's alluding to Jesus.
It's alluding to him, but it's not the person of Jesus.
So I'm thinking, then I saw another power come up out of North America who spoke like Jesus, but really had the voice of Satan.
Well, he had two horns like Jesus and then spoke like the dragon Satan. Yeah.
Okay. See, it's good to be corrected and sorted out there. I'm just having a rough go with the keys you've given us of looking at that. Unpack it for us, brother.
So that's exactly what you... So this is the key. The first word there is then in English, right? And then means something's happened and now something else is happening. Yeah. The last thing we saw, if you go back to verse 10, it says... Oh, verse 9, it says, if anyone has an ear... So we've just seen the first beast, talked about as being papal Rome. Yeah. It says, anyone has an ear, let me hear. He who leads into captivity, talking about Rome leading people into captivity, shall go into captivity. That's the deadly wound, right? Mm. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And then it says, here is the patience of the saints. Meaning, hang on. This power, the sea beast we talked about, the papal power, just hang on, all right? Endure.
Yep.
Then... John's attention is drawn to something. So the context is the deadly wound's been inflicted. We're waiting for a healing to happen.
Yep.
And while that deadly wound's inflicted, now we're seeing our attention not in the sea, the old world, but in the new world, in the earth, and now we see another power coming up.
It's almost as the deadly wound is being healed, or that begins to heal, this other power is rising up.
I've got a chart I do on the whiteboard, and it's kind of like as one's sort of going down, the other one's sort of coming back up, and they're joining time periods, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, in the old world versus the new.
Yep.
So it's spot on. And again, we know what beasts are. Beasts are powers, right? Mm. So power's coming up. We know what Earth is. Earth is the new world, North America. And the key here is the horns. So horns in the Bible, like David...
I'm interested in what you got to say here. Because there's different views on this one, isn't there, on what these two horns are?
I think there's only one, but anyway, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's why I'm interested. So we're listening very carefully.
So you see in the Psalms that horns represent salvation.
Okay.
You also see in the book of Daniel that horns are kings.
Powers.
Also in Revelation too. Yeah, Revelation 17, you see them as kings. So it's some symbol of power that leads to salvation. There's two of these things. And what's interesting is that most of these animals... I won't get into that too much. But yeah, so we've got these two horns that are coming up, which have this idea, like in the Gospels, it says it's the power of salvation. Jesus is the horn of salvation.
Yeah.
And so now we've got two of them that look like a lamb. The key here is the animal is not a lamb.
No, it looks like a lamb.
No, it doesn't.
Okay, go on.
Look what it says. It says here, it says, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had
two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. It doesn't tell us what it looks like.
True.
It just tells us the horns look like the lamb. The lamb is Jesus. So these two horns have a power of salvation in the same way that Jesus is described as the horn of salvation.
Okay.
So let's put this in context. If this beast is North America arising,
yep,
and it's got two horns, which is powers, which is salvation, because it's lamb-like, what we end up with, this might be a bit of a stretch, but get this, it's the separation of church and state. Let me tell you why.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Why are they?
And just so our listeners know, some of this is new for me. Some of this is new for me, so I'm learning from this guy.
I want you to throw me any objections you have.
Well, the reason I say that is because throughout history, even in our movement, people have come up with different views of what these horns are.
Okay.
And I can list them. I won't, but I can list them off. Because I don't want to confuse the. I don't want to confuse our listeners. That's why. So go on.
So I'll just jump to the chase. This is what this is what I see this as. Jesus is described as the horn of salvation.
Yeah, I'm with you.
The key movement about Jesus is that when he was here on earth, the freedom came from separating the things of earth, the things of God, the two
separation
kingdoms.
Of church and state.
Separating church and state. What Caesar's is Caesar's, what God is God's.
Okay.
When they were persecuted in the old world and they were fleeing across to the new world, it was because there was one big, big, big problem. The joining of church and state.
That was one horn.
One horn.
But here you've got two horns.
And in Daniel, guess what it's called? A little horn.
That's right.
In the new world, they don't have a little horn.
They have two horns.
They have two horns. They've separated something. And so what I call it is, I call it the separation from the state and separation from the church. One is to what we call republicanism, freedom from a kingly power. The other one is Protestantism, which is freedom from a pope. So when you look at the United States, that's exactly the two principles they built the system of this government on. And those two
just
principles...
Just give us that again. They are what?
So they're republicanism, and not like Trump versus Democrats, not that.
Yeah.
Republic as in they don't have a king, they don't have a monarchy.
It's the American experiment.
It's exactly what it is. And that's why it was an experiment, because it'd never been done before.
That's right.
And they're still learning from it, and they're learning some interesting lessons.
Well, the American experiment at the moment is under threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they leave the old world under one horn, the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. They go to the new world and say, we're not doing things the way the old world was. We're going to separate that little horn into two horns. And now it looks like not a man. Remember Daniel 7? It's a man. It looks like a man.
This
man
looks
eyes.
Like a lamb.
Now it looks like a lamb.
So what you've got is you've got one horn, which is the state, and you've got the other horn, which is the church, Protestantism.
Yes.
But they're well apart.
Well apart. Separation of church and state. It's enshrined in their constitution.
Okay, let's move on. Verse 12.
Last part of that one, though.
No, he's not going to let me go. Go.
It says, verse 11. It says, and he speaks.
Like a dragon.
As a dragon. So the dragon.
Does that mean he speaks like a dragon from the beginning?
Okay, I am so glad you picked up on that, because this is my pet peeve. I have many, many friends who are Bible students as well, and we argue this one all the time. And I think I win, but you can argue with me as well. So I have heard this preached many, many times, that this beast is going to come up. It's got two lamb-like horns. It's Christian in principles and values.
And he will speak like a dragon.
And at some point, he's going to speak like a dragon. And most people I hear who say that are Americans.
Well, you can understand. Look,
I can understand it. Just as I love America.
Just if you belong to Rome, the Church of Rome, this is going to be difficult.
It is.
This is also difficult for our American friends, and I get that.
I get it too. I love America.
It's difficult for us in the West too. Because here we are living in Australia. It was the United States of America that saved Australia from the Japanese invasion. I know that. My grandfather's fighting on the Kokoda track with Americans who saved the day.
My grandfather's fighting Americans in Korea. I mean, we have a long history.
We have. And so we're kind of on their side. We're almost a part of the movement.
Yeah.
So it can be quite painful.
And look, the reality is what happens in America affects us.
Well, we're almost a little state.
Here we are.
But let's go back to this. Will it speak like a dragon, or has it always spoken like? That's what I'm asking.
So here's the bottom line.
Yep.
The text to me implies from its inception, it has spoken as a dragon. From its inception, its horns have been Christ-like in the fact that they separate church from state, but it speaks like a dragon. So here's the question.
I think if you look at American history.
This is the key.
I think you've got a point.
Here's the key. The dragon in the context, remember going back to our symbols. In the previous verse, who was the dragon? Sorry, the previous verse. In verse 2, who gave the power to papal Rome? It was the dragon. Yeah.
Who was that dragon? The dragon was Rome, pagan Rome, imperial Rome, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ultimately behind that, Satan, right?
Yep.
What this is telling me is that this power, even though it's coming into the new world, it's going to have this new experiment of separation of church and state, it's still going to speak the same way that the Roman Empire spoke in all those years past. And the question now is, how did they speak? Because if you answer that question...
From day one, they spoke as a great military power.
That's exactly right.
To both the Indians, who they took land off, and openly took land off, and then the Mexicans. This is where it starts.
Yes.
Great war fought against the Mexicans. They got California, Nevada, Texas all ripped off them by force. Almost from day one, as you go through the history of the United States of America, they've been at war with someone.
Yes. Every single war.
And it's almost decade by decade, they've increased in their power, their authority, and their interference of other nations all around the world.
So the two things they have from Rome, they mirror it from day one, is the military, and the second is their legislative system. And those two things, it has from its inception. Now, the result of Rome having those two things, it results and ends up in persecution. And that's exactly where this chapter takes us. But if you go to the
next... Which is amazing for us. We've got to stop and think about that for a moment. It's amazing for us to think of Rome and the United States, Papal Rome and the United States joining together and bringing persecution and trouble upon the world. Even today, that is an amazing thought.
It is amazing thought, but it's getting much easier to see it.
Well, because we're seeing them exercise increasingly, both powers,
sides, yeah.
Increasingly exercising the authority. Where do you want me to go, mate?
Have a look at verse 12.
He exercised, talking about the United States, exercised all the authority of the first beast, Rome, and he required all the earth and its people to worship the first beast, Rome, whose fatal wound had been healed. This is amazing. And I would ask you to start off with, is this past, present, or future?
I think it's okay. It's a bit of all.
Yeah.
So in verse 12, very first part, it says he exercised all the authority. So here's the cool thing with this picture that we're getting from Jesus. Remember, this is Jesus telling us this. This isn't some scary nightmare story Stephen King's writing. This is Jesus saying, hey, listen, guys, I want to tell you something.
He's unpacking it for us.
He's unpacking it. And I love how you read it. You were just like plugging those symbols in exactly as
we discovered. Well, I think that's how you got... Once you got the symbols, that's how you got to read it.
It just unlocks.
Yeah, yeah.
So you said exactly the right thing there. It says he... So that's America, right? He exercises. Let me ask you a question. I know you exercise.
Not much the last week.
Well, we're...
A little bit worried, actually.
Why do we exercise?
We exercise for fitness. We exercise so we increase in strength. All those different things.
So we've got a power here that's coming up out of nothing. There's no multitudes of peoples there like the old world had. It's come up out of nothing. But as it comes up, Jesus tells us this thing is going to be exercising and exercising and exercising and exercising. And what does it exercise specifically? It says exercises all the authority of the first beast. The authority of the first beast came from who? The dragon. So that was pagan Rome. So it's exercising what? It's exercising in the craft of ancient Rome. And the funny thing is, if you go to America, if you live there, you look at the Capitol buildings, look at the state's legislators, you look at the iconology, you look at the symbols, it shouts Rome.
Yeah, it does.
It's just incredible.
Yeah, it does.
And so what we get this picture of...
Someone in America knew their history.
Yeah, they sure did.
They're architects of both their buildings and their legislature knew their history.
It's phenomenal. Mm. I mean, and the thing is, you get this picture that it starts with nothing, but it grows and grows and grows, it exercises, and that's exactly what we see with American history, to the point where it says, as you just read very nicely, it says, and he causes the earth... Now, remember, we've already said that the earth in the context is not the world. The world is everyone. The earth is the North American or United States, whatever you want to specifically narrow it down to. But it says it forces. Now, notice what we say Babylon had, the mouth of the first beast. It had the mouth of Babylon, which was to force. And now we see that the second beast comes on the world stage. It starts off small. It grows up, but it becomes basically the muscle. In fact, these are my nicknames. I call the dragon the architect because he designs the whole plan. I call the sea beast. He's the front man. He's the one that receives worship. And then I call this one, the land beast, I call him the muscle. because he's the one with the muscle and the might to do the thing.
So Satan the architect.
Satan's the architect.
Papal Rome.
Front man.
And in North America.
Yeah, the muscle. And so what we see is the muscle is going to force or cause. And you notice very quickly it pivots. Remember in verse 11 we have the two horns, separation of church and state. Yeah. By the end of verse 12 we have forced worship.
Okay, we're moving on. Verse 13.
Let's do it.
I like this. I have my own view on this. I'm going to be interested in yours.
I want to hear yours first then.
He did astounding miracles, even making fire flash down to earth from the sky while everyone was watching. This is just me. And I'm not saying this is right either.
Yeah, sure.
But this is my own study. I haven't read this anywhere. I haven't got any evidence for it except what I have found in my study of this. Because I study it like you do.
Yeah, we're all students.
I've studied it over the years and I've really enjoyed it. Acts chapter 2 I'm drawn to there.
Oh, okay. Day Pentecost.
It's Pentecost fire coming down from heaven. And I just see religious symbiology there. As there was a true fire from heaven that launched the church, Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, out of the United States will come a false religious fire.
False revival. Mm. Yeah, I can agree with that.
That's how I see
it. I can see that.
I'm not saying that I'm completely correct on that, but that certainly has been in my head for a number of years.
Yeah, I can see that. And I don't think that's too dissimilar to how I would see it.
Yeah.
When I first came across this passage and I was reading this, I and many other people studying it with me were all focused and fixated on, because it was around 2002 that I was reading this, right, my first time. And it was right, happened to be right then that in the news, George W. Bush was rolling out the Star Wars program.
Okay, fire from heaven,
which
weapons.
Which it actually said that they had an ability to drop liquid fire from the sky upon their enemies. And so we're all going, Revelation 13, verse 13. But this is why it's got to be very, very careful. We've got to let the text explain itself.
I think that's where you've got to go back to the symbols in the Bible. You've got to go back to the keys.
Don't
so you've got to go back to the keys and you've got to work out what is fire.
Yes.
Go on.
So the first, there's a couple of keys in this text to discredit my initial ideas of destruction of some mass, the thing. Look at this. It says, and he, this is verse 14, sorry, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by the signs he was granted to do. So the fire is called a sign. That's the first thing. And the purpose of the sign was to deceive the people in North America who saw it. So it's not about destruction, this fire. It's about deception.
That's right.
Okay? So now the question is, well, what's the deception? What is this great fiery deception? Now, let me be very honest and transparent up front. I have no idea what the fire is going to be. I don't even claim to know what the fire is going to be. But I'll tell you what the fire is going to achieve. Here's the key. And the text tells us this. I said the other day, 404 verses in Revelation, 60% Old Testament. We go to the Old Testament, we find two very interesting stories about fire falling from heaven. Mm. One is with Elijah in Mount Carmel, 1 Kings, right? And the story there is really, really simple. Whoever can call fire down,
you're going to worship that God.
You're worshipping that God.
And that's a confrontation between Baal, the pagan god, and the true God.
Correct.
Elijah on one side, and I don't know, 400 or 600 pagan prophets.
Yeah, Baal's prophets now. Yeah. So we see that picture, and I think that ties into this very nicely. But let's go one step deeper. In 2 Kings chapter 1, there's a story where Elijah now, so that the Mount Carmel thing's finished, Elijah has gone off into a mountain, and now Ahab wants to arrest him. So he sends up his troops. His troops come up, and it says there's a captain with 50 soldiers. They go up the mountain, and there's Elijah, and they say, "Oh, man of God, come down with us today." Elijah turns to them and says, "If I am the man of God, let fire fall down from heaven and consume
you." I'm glad I wasn't these dudes.
Oh, I'll tell you what. So guess what happens? Fire falls down and consumes them. So what did that fire represent? It represented that Elijah was the true man of God, i.e. prophet. Okay? This happens another time. And then the third time, God says, "Okay, that's enough. Go down with them." So here's my point. Fire falling from heaven in the Old Testament is the evidence, is the proof that the one calling it down is God's prophet, his messenger, his mouthpiece. So what does that mean? It means this second land beast is the false prophet of Revelation. See, when you get down in
other
parts, you have the beast, you have the dragon, you have the false prophet. So the role of the United States will be to do some kind of miraculous deception that will prove to the people that it is on God's side. God is on their side. They are the mouthpiece for God. And we kind of see that a lot, even in their rhetoric now. We see things like, God bless America, God bless our troops.
In God we trust. Donald Trump's selling the Bible.
I just heard that today. He's Easter egg or something. He's selling a Bible.
I think we're going to have a break and we're going to come back and finish this chapter.
You're listening to the Aussie Pastor here on Faith FM.
Song 10,000 Reasons by Matt Redmond. So you've got one more chance to send us your question, 0488 880 851, or you can text us on The Aussie Pastor. Sorry, email us on theaussiepastor@gmail.com or text us on 0488 880 851, and we're back.
Okay, where are we going to start? Verse 14, or do you want to go back?
No, look, let's just jump straight in. Well, let's jump into 14. Yeah, let's do it.
And with all the miracles he, the United States, North America, was able to perform on behalf of the Church of Rome, the first beast, he deceived all the people who belonged to the world. He ordered the people to make a great statue of the first beast, who was fatally wounded and then came back to life. It's all yours, Robbie.
Okay, this is where it gets super exciting.
Yeah.
Because we are on the cusp of this.
Yeah.
Everything we read before this is pretty much happening. Well, except the fire from heaven thing, that hasn't happened yet.
Well,
it's happening.
Elements of that could be happening.
So watch this. In, like you said in verse 14, right? The key here is he deceives them. So I like the way you're reading it. Like you're just sort of substituting in the symbols and things as we go through. It's saying he deceives those who dwell on the earth. And those who dwell on the earth, we could say that they're the North American people. We could say even more specifically they're the American citizens, right? The people of America, United States. So the people there are deceived by the signs, which is that fire we saw before. And then the key part there is, and it says, telling those who dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast. So I want to unpack this for a second.
I'm seeing Daniel again.
Yeah, we've got, there's echoes of Daniel in this.
Three.
For sure, yeah.
Daniel 3, the image.
What's super fascinating here is if you understand American governance, America, you know the expression, for the people,
by
the people. It's the idea that the government exists to serve and is selected by the people, right?
Well, that's the experiment, because it's never been like that before. It's always been before the king.
Exactly. So what we have here, if you look carefully at this text, we have the state, right, which is the beast, going to the people saying, you should make an image to the beast that was and wasn't and that deadly wounds. So that's papal Rome, right? Mm. So put this in context. What power on earth in the history of humanity would require its subjects, its citizens, to say that they should make the image for another power, right? So what I'm trying to allude to here is this is a democracy.
Yeah.
This political system is requiring the people to demand this, to request this, to vote for it, to referendum, whatever it's going to be. This is the American system that we're seeing portrayed in these passages. And so what this tells me is that the people are going to have a choice. And then notice what the next verse says, verse 15.
So North America was then permitted to give life to this image so it could speak.
Okay, stop there for a second. North America, the United States, was then... We're live here, people. We've got a big crowd outside doing great things. It's okay. Leave them. They're fine. They're having fun. But here's the key. Here's the key.
They're having fun and so are we.
The key is then the state was permitted.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It means that the people give permission to the state.
The people gave the permission. So this is fundamental. This isn't going to be some, you know, sometimes in these almost fictitious, they are fictitious, Christian movies and things about the Antichrist coming and the end of days and all this stuff, there's like this single figure that shows up in a suit and got a barcode in his head. That's not the case. Revelation's painting a picture where the masses will be appealed to by the state to enact something, and they're going to vote for it and demand it, and they will give their power. It's going to be a popular vote.
Can you unpack that more for me, or does the Bible not allow that? And what I mean by that is, can you get even more prescriptive on what you think is going to happen, or is this something that we need to wait and see?
I think the answer is it can unpack it, whether we've got the time in this episode. And what we really want to do is go back to Daniel. Remember how we've seen Daniel is sort of being echoed here into Revelation. And it echoes, as you rightly said, Daniel chapter 3. Mm. So in Daniel chapter 3, we have about political power, Nebuchadnezzar, setting up an image. And interestingly, guess what it is? It's 66 cubits by 6 cubits. Anyway, that's another story.
It is another story, but it's God's little hand.
Yeah.
Not his little, it's his big handprint in there to say, hey, what I'm telling you here is divine, it's supernatural, you can trust me.
Yeah.
He does that all the time through the Bible.
Yeah, he drops these little Easter eggs in, and it's like just to make sure you're on the right track.
Our atheist and evolutionist friends and brothers, they miss all this.
It's a shame. Oh, well, I missed it for many years, 20 years, half my life I've missed it. So to answer your question, this in Daniel we see echoes of this idea that there's forced worship by the state. So
is this whole issue, this controversy, this war between light and darkness, and we're looking at darkness today, am I going too far or is it over worship?
It is 100% over worship. Why? Because remember back in first class, in Revelation 12 verse 7, there was that political war that started and there was two sides. And the war was over the idea of whose throne. Yeah. Remember, the throne is the key here. So to show allegiance to the throne, the issue is worship. So just jump 1 second. Let's go jump to chapter 14.
You want to go to 14? Yeah,
chapter 14, verse 6 and 7. So we'll look at this more detail tomorrow, but chapter 14, verse 6 and 7.
And I saw another angel flying through the sky, carrying the eternal gospel to proclaim to the people who belong to the world, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. Fear God, he shouted, give glory to him, for the time has come when he will sit as judge. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all the springs. I can actually see the Sabbath in there, but that's another time.
That's exactly what it is. But yeah, so here's the key. In God's point of view, he's calling us, he's inviting us to worship. To show our allegiance, to make the vote.
Yeah, it's an invitation. He's not forcing us.
But in this chapter, it's a force, and you're worshipping the wrong side.
You know what
story.
I'm noticing here? First, he tries to deceive and seduce us, Satan.
Yes.
And in the end, when he can't seduce and deceive you, he'll try and force you.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of the beast.
His game plan hasn't changed.
No.
He's just doing the same old thing.
So he'll try and deceive and seduce you to start off with, and possibly get most of the world with that.
That's right.
And then he's going to say, well, for you guys who are left, I'm now going to force you.
Now, let's unpack this worship thing, right? If he's going to force us to worship, why and how and what's the connection to worship? Go back to chapter 12, yesterday's text, and look at verse 17. There. The last verse that we finished up on, the war verse. Read that verse again.
And the dragon was angry with the woman and declared war against her and the remnant of her seed, all who keep God's commandments and have the testimony of Jesus.
Okay, so watch this.
Yep.
It says the dragon has gone to make war with the remnant, right? Or the offspring of her seed, the last remnant.
These are the last people before Jesus comes.
That's exactly right. So remember the dragon? At the top level behind it all is Satan himself, right? But then there's the player.
Yep.
Who's the dragon? Or where's the dragon characteristic at the end of time? We've just read it. Chapter 10, chapter 13, verse 11. It's the United States speaking as a dragon.
Yeah.
So that dragon that's making that final stand at the actual player, it's not Rome anymore. Now it's the United States.
Again, you're saying the US is the muscle.
It's the muscle.
They're the ones who have the muscle to force. Is that why you can look at world events today and you can see China and you can see Russia and we hear talk about the defeat and the fall of America, that we can kind of take that for a grain of salt?
Because
this to me is kind of indicating that just before Jesus comes, that the United States of America are the main players.
100%. I think a lot of this other stuff, there's good conversations around China and Islam and all these things and atheism and communism in Baal prophecy. There's good answers to that.
Yeah.
But you got to understand something. I have a lot of Chinese friends who ask me, where's China in Daniel chapter 2? Daniel chapter 2 is a great image, you know, Babylon all the way down to Europe, divide of Europe. And where's China? China was before Babylon, it was after Babylon, rah, rah, rah. And this is my answer. China is not a focus in that story because God was talking to a Babylonian king and said, from here, where you are, I'm going to draw a line all the way to my second coming. It doesn't have to go through China. China doesn't have to be a part of that.
True.
So anyway, we're going to unpack China and stuff another time. But in that verse you just read where it says that the dragon's wants to make war, notice specifically the characteristics of the people. Those that keep the commandments.
Yeah, I've looked at that very carefully. And have.
And have a testimony of Jesus.
You need to define what they are.
So when
the reason being, because these are the people who are going to stand up. And if you want to be a part of that, you need to know the characteristics. So those characteristics through the Holy Spirit leading of Jesus can become yours.
Yeah.
Go on.
So when you think about the commandments, where do you go? Where's your mind go back to?
I go Exodus 20.
Exodus 20. And that's where we find 10 commandments, right? Yeah. Jesus was asked one day, hey, what's the greatest of all those commandments? Yeah. And his answer was, love
the Lord, love each other and love God.
That's it. Simple. Mm. Two directions of love. How do we show love in the first commandment to... So for those who may not know, there's 10 commandments. The first four are the love to God, and the last six are love to man, right? What's the first commandment to the men? Like
to the men?
Commandment number five.
Commandment... The Sabbath, obey your mum and dad.
It says... yeah, what's about mum and dad? What's it say?
Obey...
You guys know? I'm asking the live audience here. What's it say? Honour your parents, right? Yeah. Do you know that that word honour is the root for the word worship?
Okay.
Now, why do you need to worship your parents? Well, or honour your parents?
You don't worship your parents.
Well, in the context of the honour, like it's not worship as in the deity, God. Right? But why is God calling us to honour our parents?
Because they're who we came from.
Because they created us. Mm. So when you that's the first of all the ones in the six for man, right?
Yeah.
We start with acknowledging our creator, which is our parents.
The first four commandments are to God. The last six are our relationship between each other.
So in the ones to God,
yeah.
Which is the one that calls us to worship? Number four.
Yeah, well, they all do in a way, don't they? Yeah. But number four is very proactive worship. But and I would argue that all four are called to worship.
I agree. The reason I'm focusing on number four is because number four tells us why.
Yeah.
Because he is our creator. So notice
that's
this.
What Revelation 14, where we go tomorrow, calls us to, worshipping the creator. One of the last great... One of the last great calls to mankind as we split between those who are going to live in righteousness and light and those who are going to live in darkness is to worship God, and it has a very strong tie to the Sabbath because the words that are used in Revelation 14 are the same that are used in Genesis and Exodus talking about the Sabbath.
Exactly.
So it is a call to the Sabbath.
Yeah. Well, here's the point. If the first four of the commandments, they tell you why you're worshipping is because he's the creator.
Yeah.
The last six commandments tell you why you're loving is because your parents are the creator.
Yeah.
So the focus here now in Revelation 13 is we're being forced to worship. The question is, which of those 10 commandments are the ones that they have the problem with? It's not number one. It's not number two. Well, anyway, number three, number four, number five. The problem is number four, because number four
With Protestantism, which should know better, it is number four.
So we'll unpack all that stuff tomorrow. But the key you asked is, how's this all going to transpire? It's going to transpire in this simple fashion, if the prophecy is accurate, and I think it is. We're going to find ourselves in a time when there is going to be forced worship that will be in contrast and contradiction to the commandments of God.
Can I take that further?
Absolutely.
I think if it's over-worship, this is just my view, it's over-worship. Right from the beginning, this study, and the whole conflict's over-worship. If the Sabbath is central to worship, and I believe it is, I think the Sabbath is a lot more about a lot more than just commandment keeping. We need rest. We come to Jesus on the Sabbath. We get healing.
Yeah.
He renews us. He refreshes us so that we can go out and face a hostile world. And I think the Sabbath is very much about rest. However, what I think is that if the Sabbath is central to worship, then it makes sense to me that at the end of time, when this all really unpacks and blows up, Sabbath has got to be a central point in this battle between light and darkness.
I couldn't agree with you more. And we'll see that absolutely crystal clear in Revelation 14 in that last message. Because it actually uses the
you might as well say remember the Sabbath day.
Yeah.
That's how clear that is.
Yeah.
And for people who say, oh, the Sabbath is not in the New Testament, the easiest thing to do other than go to the book of Acts where the Sabbath is everywhere is to go to the book of Revelation, one of the last chapters in the book that talks about one of the last times we'll be on earth. The great clarion call. And it's what people are called to is worshipping the Creator, and at the central point of that great invitation from God is the Sabbath, which, by the way, is why when I do programs to bring people to Jesus, I'm doing Bible studies to bring people to Jesus, you know, the Sabbath for me is number three in my Bible studies or in my preaching. I deal with who Jesus is, then I deal with how you can talk to Jesus and how you can hear him, and then I go straight to the Sabbath.
Because that's what the... It's not that the Sabbath is such a big deal, but worship of God on the Sabbath is a big deal.
If you look... I love that you're doing that.
That's why Satan's attacked the Sabbath. Yeah. That's what it's all about. He's not so offended about the seventh day in itself. He's offended that God set apart the seventh day for humanity to spend with God, because he knows that if we spend the seventh day with God, as God asks, man, we're going to be powerful Christians and we're going to stand up to these deceptions. He knows it. He's trying to separate. You know, I fell in love with a girl at college. She loved another bloke. The best way I could think to get them apart was to separate them.
Yeah.
So that I could spend time. I can spend time with her and not him. I was a Satan back then, mate.
Yeah.
And that's what Satan wants to do. The reason he doesn't want the Sabbath is because all of a sudden you've got 24 hours with Jesus. He hates it.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to him.
This is why, like in creation, in chapter 2, right, is the creation of human, Adam, Eve. That, like, immediately after they come into existence, Sabbath. They're introduced into this 24-hour space of time. And it is literal time. Even the Hebrew attests to that. Yeah. Literal time where they're just basking in the presence of their maker, their God, their friend.
And, this is not a Seventh-day Adventist thing.
Well, Jesus comes along. He's a Jew, right? Yeah. Of all counts and purposes, he's a Jew. And he comes along and says, the Sabbath was not given to just man to be some burden. The other way around. I got it the wrong way around. But it's a gift given to humanity is my point.
The Sabbath was made for man.
Yes, not the other way around.
And it's all about spending time with Jesus. And that's why Satan takes such objection to it, and why at the very end, what he's still trying to do is separate us desperately from Jesus.
Yeah.
So he goes after the Sabbath. And he doesn't just go after the Sabbath. He goes after your Bible study. He goes
your
after your prayer.
Yeah.
Anything that has to do with you and Jesus, he's going to go after. But because the Sabbath is a big one, of course it's a big one. Even us guys as pastors, what are we doing? We're working all week. We don't spend the time with God during the week, even though we work for God, that we do on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Because we set aside the Sabbath to do what? Spend time with God. It's so, so powerful.
It's also a symbol of the vote.
Yeah.
When we talk about the vote before, there's two kingdoms now. There's this
powerful symbol.
And so the vote is, enter into my rest. I mean, this is Hebrews chapter 4. This is the book of Joshua. It's about entering into the rest to show that you want to be. I mean, how, you know, you want to be with this girlfriend of yours in college. The way to show someone.
I did win that in the end.
Oh, there you go.
And then I met my wife and went another direction. Hunty knows the story.
If you want to show your loyalty to someone, enter into the time with them.
Yeah.
And so it's very clear as we get to this end last chapter of the great earth drama, there's the voting booth once again. It's not two trees this time.
Yeah.
Now it's 2 days. Which day you want to enter into? And, you know, if we went back to Daniel chapter 7, we'd find that this power that we've already identified as the Holy Roman Empire of the Dark Ages, it was specifically prophesied that it would attempt to change God's time and his law. And the only law and time that's connected in Scripture is the Sabbath commandment.
You've got 45 seconds. I wish we could get into this more.
We'll have to pick this up tomorrow.
Oh, man, I just want to get into, you know, the mark on your forehead and the mark on your hand.
We'll have to do it tomorrow. We can't end it
here. It's so powerful.
Yeah.
You want to just say something in the last 30 seconds to close this off?
The thing that I love about the fact that Jesus has chosen to give us this information, this isn't, you know, like I said, Stephen King horror movie. This is Jesus going, hey, let me get aside you and guide you through what's coming. And the reason he does it is because he wants you to know that we have an enemy to our souls. Wherever we are right now in our life, there is an enemy against our soul, and Jesus wants us to know the plan behind it.
Thank you, mate. We got one last song, Hunty?
Yeah, we sure do.
And it makes my heart, there is an enemy. Amazing is your love.
Favorite song, Hunty, and you know what? Sing that one in church.
Yeah, we do.
Too.
We sing it well. Yeah,
it's a beautiful. Now, Robbie, is this the end of the study? Or are we going to keep going?
I think we're running out of time, pretty much. But we haven't finished the chapter, and I'm sure if there's people following us along, which we know there are, they are going to go, but what about the next verse, which is the mark of the beast? What about?
I was a bit frustrated myself that we never got there.
Yeah, so
we're going to go there first tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I think we've got to pick up. We were going to do chapter 14 in its entirety tomorrow, but I think we've got to finish this off. We can't leave people hanging.
We can leak over into our program later on if we don't finish this. Yeah. We're going to have
Tuesday.
This Tuesday because he'll be on the plane.
We'll give it our best. Yeah. I think we'll do well tomorrow. We'll finish up on chapter 13 and get into 14.
We'll do well. I'm not sure we'll do well, mate. Hey, I've really enjoyed this.
What was the best part of chapter 13 so far?
Oh, I love the Sabbath. I must admit to you, I have it's not because I'm a Seventh-day Adventist either. I have this great affinity with the Sabbath because it's this time I can spend with Jesus, and I need it really bad.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, look, that too. I liked how you said before that you like to emphasize the Sabbath, at least in your top three topics you study with people, right?
I mean, I go to college and they told me to put it way down the track.
Yeah.
Man, I got it at number three and I put it at number one, only they need to know who Jesus is first.
Yeah, because they've got to know why they need a Sabbath,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but yeah.
I wrote a book. It's only a little book. It's called The Sabbath Gift. And I wrote this book because I wanted people to see that this Sabbath is not... I always hear people, it's such a burden. Why are you spending 24 hours doing nothing and unplugging from social media? I consider it the greatest gift ever given to humans, other than life, right? And it's for the opportunity of communing with God and entering into this relationship and all these sorts of things. And I just find it tremendous that it takes the effort to put this into Revelation 13.
I think we're going to get you back and we're going to talk about the Sabbath in the not-too-distant future. Hey, can you finish with prayer?
Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for revealing to us these insights in Revelation 13. We're not done yet. Please continue to lead us tomorrow in the next presentation. Bless our listeners across Australia right now in their journey of understanding the revelation of Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.
Thanks, Robbie. Thanks, Hunty. We're going to see you back tomorrow at 6:30 Eastern Time, 3:30 Western Time. I'm getting pretty good
at that. You're getting very good at it.
Yep, well done.
Yeah, my name's Lloyd Grolleman. I'm the Aussie pastor. And you know what? I love you.
I'm Robbie. I love you too.
And I'm Hunty, but you know what? Jesus and God love you so much more.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining the Aussie Pastor. If you enjoyed today's program and would like to find out more about Jesus, our ministry, or ways to support us, go to aussiepastor.com.